Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Tom Gilson. Today on ID the Future, we begin a series in remembrance of the late Philip E. Johnson, the pioneering thinker, networker, organizer, speaker, and writer who played such a crucial role in the development and growth of the intelligent design movement. Most of this series comes out of talks given at a symposium presented in his memory in Berkeley, California in November 2019. Today we hear from Stephen C. Meyer, director of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, followed by recorded reflections from Philip Johnson himself.
Welcome, everyone, to a symposium in honor of Philip E. Johnson, Professor Emeritus of Law at Berkeley, whose memorial many of us attended earlier this afternoon. His wife, Kathy, thought that a really fitting way of giving tribute to Phil would be for some of the scientists and scholars who were, in a way, with him from the beginning to share some reflections on his influence in their lives as scholars and scientists, and how that influence is continuing in the work that they're doing today. I'm going to start just by reflecting on how I met Phil and how some of the folks in this group came together. I met Phil at a luncheon in 1989, where I was introduced to him by Mark Labberton, the former pastor at this church, the Berkeley First Presbyterian Church. Mark and I were both grad students in Cambridge at the same time, and good friends. He was doing work in theology, I was doing work in the philosophy of science, and he called me up one day and said, there's this brilliant but quirky law professor from back home who's gotten obsessed with evolution. Would you be willing to talk with him? And I think the manner in which he addressed me suggested maybe he was hoping I would talk him out of his new obsession, but when the two of us met, it was clear we were on the same wavelength. As our relationship developed, Phil would come up regularly to Cambridge. We'd walk the backs of the Cambridge College looking at the pea gravel, trying to sort through this whole issue about Darwinism and the ideas that were first germinating about intelligent design and how they all, how the different things fit together. And after a couple of months, he had produced a manuscript. And I was going back to the United States in the summer of 1988, and I took a copy of it with me, shared it with Paul Nelson, who's on the panel with us today. We were attending a conference called Sources of Information, Content, and DNA, where some of the early leaders in the intelligent design research community or movement were meeting for a conference. Paul was absolutely taken by this manuscript, super lively prose. In fact, one of my great regrets is that I don't still have that first copy, because the editors of Darwin on Trial, which the manuscript later became, kind of toned it down a little bit. But it was lively prose. In any case, a couple of years later, Paul and I were on a summer research project with Bill Dembski, the mathematician who's made such important and seminal contributions to the intelligent design idea. And we were back in Cambridge, and a mutual friend set us up with Doug Axe, who's on the panel. Doug came in and gave a long lecture on gene expression, and it became clear to us that Doug, who was on a postdoc at Cambridge, a recent PhD from Caltech, was also friendly to this idea of intelligent design. And I can remember saying to Doug, wait, you went to Caltech, and you believe in intelligent design too? And he said, well, you went to Cambridge, stupid. And I turned to Paul and I said, how many more people do we know like this? And he got up. He'd been in this kind of network of folks for longer than anyone else. And he wrote 15 names of people about our age who were coming out of PhD programs at elite institutions. Bill Dembski was at the University of Chicago. Paul was at Chicago. And I thought, you know, this shouldn't be happening. And so one of us, I don't know, remember which, one of us got in touch with Phil and said, hey, there's an exciting network of younger people that are also thinking the kind of things that you are, skeptical thoughts about Darwinism, sympathetic thoughts to the idea that life may bear evidence of design. And within a year, Phil had put together a little meeting at a beach house on the California coast called Pajara Dunes. And he brought together 12 of these, underground dissidents to meet with him And we had people in paleontology and Jonathan Wells, who was in developmental biology and embryology. Doug was there. Paul was there. Mike Behe was there in biochemistry. And out of that, a movement of scientists and scholars kind of congealed. And some of those people are here with us today. And we thought it might be fun to hear from each of them about the influence that Phil played in their thinking and what they're doing now. I have one other thing to say, which is that there are other people who would have wanted to present today who are, in a sense, in the generation coming up behind us. And I'll tell a little bit about that at the end, but some of those folks are not in a safe position to speak openly, but some of us older hands are, and so we're going to share some of the different facets of the intellectual movement and research community that Phil Johnson very much helped to spawn. So first up is actually a little clip of Phil speaking courtesy of our friends at Illustra Media, who many times interviewed him, and we get to hear from Phil himself for about 8 minutes.
I sometimes wonder why anybody talks about anything else, because this is the most interesting topic there is. It's our creation story. Where do we come from? How did we get here? What brought us into existence? What is our relationship to reality as a whole? That's what Darwinian evolution is about, and that's what theology, religion is about too. It's the big question. Now that's one thing. Another thing is that I saw that the scientists were very confused about this topic. On the one hand, they wanted to say that they had, by impartial, open-minded investigation, discovered this materialist mechanism of creation, the Darwinian mechanism, mutation and selection. But they haven't discovered it at all. They haven't demonstrated that it can create anything. Their evidence is somewhere between extremely weak and non-existent. But what has happened is that they've incorporated this materialist philosophical principle into their science, and they never question it. So it takes an outsider to question this, to break the rules, to open the subject up. And so that gave me an opportunity, and it's been lots of fun. I enjoy every minute of it. Mainstream biology has become fettered to a philosophy. It grew out of the great war between science and religion that was promulgated in the late 19th century, until this materialist bias became just solidified as a dogma that nobody could question. And so you see the biologists saying amazing things. Francis Crick, one of the founders of modern molecular biology and a true materialist, says biologists have to constantly remind themselves that what they study was not designed, it evolved. What he's saying is they have to ignore the facts and stick with the philosophy. Richard Lewontin, a Harvard professor, geneticist, one of the leading biologists of our time, says, "We believe in scientific evolution not because of the facts, but because we have an a priori commitment to materialism as a philosophy." So they're as stuck with that materialism as any religious fundamentalist is with his Bible. See, they say, we have the answer before we investigate the facts. We go to the facts because we want to illustrate what we already know to be true. And that's not the scientific method. That's dogmatism. The best way for the non-scientist to understand this is to think about a book or a computer program, like Windows 95, for example. Now, this consists of thousands and thousands of lines of intricate computer code. Those lines of code are imprinted on a disk or some type of an electronic medium. They could be written out on ink and paper, but they consist fundamentally of highly complex, specified information. Now, the same thing would be true of a book like the works of Shakespeare. You cannot explain complex, specified information in terms of the material medium in which it is impressed. You can know all that there is to know about the chemical laws that govern the combining of ink and paper, and you know nothing about the content of the plays of Shakespeare, or even the telephone directory of your hometown. The information is something fundamentally different from the material medium in which it is imprinted, and you can change it from one medium, from ink and paper, to another, to, let's say, a silicon disk, and it's still the same information. Now, where does the information come from? The fundamental error of the materialists who rule biology is that they want to explain the chemicals. They want to explain the matter. They don't have any explanation for the information content. And once that's realized, then that's their downfall. The argument against intelligent design is based on materialist philosophy. The argument for intelligent design is based on observation of the facts. Now, that's my definition of good science. It's observation of the facts. Now, when you observe the facts, as Michael Behe has done, what do you observe? You observe this incredible pattern of interrelated complexity, of various complex parts that all need each other in order to function at all. That's what you see. When you say, how could this come about through random material processes, through mutation and natural selection, you get philosophical arguments. You get excuses for the lack of evidence. That's pseudoscience. Intelligent design comes from the facts. Materialist explanations come from the philosophical assumptions. And that's why intelligent design is good science. What we need to do is educate not just scientists, because the scientific culture is very resistant to change. We have to get to other intellectuals. We have to get to the religious people. We have to get to the culture at large. You know, within the religious world, for example, many people are completely deceived by this. They have been told that, oh, this is just saying that God created gradually. Science is just telling us about the how and is leaving the why to religion. And so if you're just willing to be a little flexible in your interpretation of the book of Genesis, there's no problem. This isn't true at all. What we're getting is a materialist philosophy, and it's not fact. So the religious people have to understand that. The intellectuals in the literary departments, the sociologists and so on, have to learn that they should put their critical techniques at work, their reasoning skills, on these scientific dogmas. They've done it with other dogmas, but Darwinism has been off limits. See, it's the sacred cow. Nobody's allowed to challenge that. So we have to approach this from a lot of different angles within the scientific world and in the general intellectual world and even in the popular culture to get minds opened. You know, that's the title of my latest book, Defeating Darwinism by Opening Minds. And it's the opening minds that's the crucial element in the situation. I speak at university campuses, sometimes with official academic endorsement in departments, maybe with university officials introducing me. Sometimes I'm more on my own. I'm speaking at churches, and I'm speaking through the entire publications and broadcasting medium of the Christian world. I'm doing talk show radio. I'm writing for scholarly journals. So one has to do this at each and every level, because the most obvious ways to communicate with the public are closed off. The television networks, especially public television, the universities at the highest level, the scientific world, there the view is, we must shut down any discussion of this topic of materialism and Darwinian evolution, because if people ever learn the problems, oh, there'll be all sorts of trouble. So we must make sure that they just get told the catechism again and again. So it's hard to attack that frontally, but fortunately we have lots of channels of communication in this culture, and we can go all around it, and that's what we're doing.
You've been listening to Stephen C. Meyer speaking at a November 2019 symposium in honor of the late Philip E. Johnson, along with previously recorded thoughts from Johnson himself. Stay tuned to this podcast for more to come. And for ID of the Future, I'm Tom Gilson. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.